Do you recognize this voice?
You will respect my authority!
If you don't, you are probably not a male between the ages of 18 and 24. Otherwise, you would almost certainly know that it's Eric Cartman, the most famous of the foul-mouthed fourth graders who inhabit South Park, the Colorado town that is the setting for Comedy Central's most popular show. 9-year-old Cartman is number 10 on TV Guide's top 50 cartoon characters of all time. He's also the subject of today's In Character, our series exploring famous American fictional characters. We sent NPR's health policy correspondent Julie Rovner to Los Angeles to do the story. We will let her explain why. Oh, and you know that disclaimer they usually show before each South Park episode, warning how the show will offend just about everybody? Well, consider yourself warned.
Okay, I interview important people every day. Congressmen, senators, presidential candidates. But I got to admit, the prospect of interviewing Eric Cartman, entrepreneur, con man, and all-around juvenile evildoer, made me more than a little bit nervous. Who's your hero?
This might sound kind of egotistical, but it's actually, I'd have to say myself. And it's only because, like, if you could see me, like, I actually do really cool stuff, and most of the kids think I'm really cool. And just basically everything about me is so cool that I look up to myself and it becomes this sort of, goes back on itself. Like, you look up to myself and then it raises me up and then I look at myself and it raises me up again. I just get cooler all the time.
I admit it, I'm a fan. In fact, I've been a fan since before there even was a South Park series. We'll get back to Cartman in a minute, but first, let me tell you a story. Back in the beginning, which is about 12 years ago now, there was a 5-minute short called The Spirit of Christmas.
We wish you a Merry Christmas!
Wait a minute.
What?
Aren't you Jewish, Kyle?
Yeah, I think so.
Dude, Jewish people don't celebrate Christmas.
What?
You're supposed to sing Hanukkah songs.
Dreidel, 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 I made you out of clay.
Dreidel, I'm Elisa Goodman. I'm from Los Angeles. I'm married to Ken Marcus, who is Julie Rovner's cousin.
Elisa used to be a casting director in Hollywood. Her casting partner, Abra Edelman, had a niece who was married to comedy writer Matt Silverstein.
And he gave Abra a tape of The Spirit of Christmas, and that's how we first learned about it. It was pretty outrageous.
To say the least, you've now heard just about all of it that we can play on the radio. Suffice it to say, the plot involved Cartman and his pals Kyle, Stan, and Kenny magically summoning skater Brian Boitano to break up a fight between Santa and Jesus. Really? Now, when they got the video, Elisa says they were given instructions.
That it was a secret tape and that we could not make copies of it. I think it had come from George Clooney, if stories are consistent.
The story goes that Clooney made hundreds of copies of The Spirit of Christmas. Apparently, so did everyone else who laid hands on it. Or so says Trey Parker, the voice of Cartman and the co-creator of South Park. Parker says he and partner Matt Stone were amazed at how that video, originally commissioned for $2,000 by a Fox studio executive as a Christmas card, got around.
The internet was just starting at that time, but it was all getting passed around on VHS, which is so funny to think about now, but it created this weird, you know, it took, instead of being the next, you know, it wasn't like Chocolate Rain where the next day it was all over the place. It was like 2 months later, all of a sudden people were saying, hey guys, I want to show you this thing I saw in New York, and they're showing us our own stuff.
That video would lead to South Park the series, and 2 Emmys and a Peabody Award later, the rest is TV history. Last month, South Park launched season 12 with send-ups of Britney Spears, teen drug use, and the fall of New York Governor Eliot Spitzer. And how did Cartman come to be the star? Parker says at the beginning, the four boys really didn't have particularly distinctive personalities. Parker and Stone based Stan and Kyle on themselves and their families and set the show in the Denver suburbs where they each grew up. But Parker says Cartman was quick to break out of the pack.
I'd say within the first season, we kind of realized, we're like, oh, Cartman's like a little Archie Bunker. You know, and we were big fans of All in the Family, and we were going back and seeing some of those reruns, and we're like, and we kind of realized what we had there in him was this kid, and especially because he was 8 years old, he was kind of free to say whatever he wanted, and he could dress up like Hitler, and he could do these because he's eight, you know, and he doesn't really know what he's doing, he doesn't care, he's just a, you know, product of his environment.
That environment being the only child of a single mother, living in a small town, eating junk food, and watching a lot of television. the overweight Cartman.
I'm not fat, I'm big boned.
Sorry, the big boned Cartman quickly became the protagonist of South Park's politically incorrect pokes at serious topics. In the current season's debut, the show took on fundraising for medical research. Cartman gets HIV from a botched blood transfusion, then purposely gives it to Kyle.
This isn't funny, AIDS isn't funny, dying isn't funny, so shut the f*** up. Well, excuse me, Kyle, for trying to keep some optimism, you know? You know, sometimes when things seem their darkest, you just need to try and stay HIV positive. But if you want to be so HIV negative all the time...
Knock it off! Right now! This isn't funny! At all!
Are you sure?
Yes!
Are you HIV positive?
Ow! Kyle!
But giving his best friend HIV isn't even close to the worst thing Cartman has done on the show. Parker says that probably goes back to an episode from 2001, when Cartman actually ground up a rival's recently deceased parents and served them to him in a bowl of chili. Parker said there was some serious debate in the writer's room about whether that was going a step too far, even for Cartman, the show's unquestioned villain.
We had that idea, and we thought it was really funny, but then we're like, all right, well, we're setting a new bar now, you know, and there was a big thing, you know, we're like, okay, well, he can't kill, that we don't want to make him a murderer, but you could obviously see how if they were going to be dead, you know, then he could feed them. And so we debated it for a long time, and then we did, and there was definitely a red, there were some people who were big Cartman fans are like, he wouldn't do that. It's crossing the line. It's crossing the line. And then there are other people going, that's awesome, because no other show would have done that. But in recent years,
Parker says he and Stone have probed a little deeper into what or who has made Cartman what he is and have decided it's his mother.
It sort of became obvious to us in, you know, we always had this thing where Cartman's mother was so sweet. She was the one that was just overly sweet to him and giving him whatever he wanted. And especially, you know, we came out to L.A. and we started to meet people out here, and I don't know if it's worse in LA than most places in the country, I hope so, but in LA we were starting to meet so many parents who were just so desperately trying to be friends to their kids, you know, and it was the thing we really picked up on, you know, was just like, these are making these really evil kids, you know?
Which led him to pen an episode in which Cartman's mother brings in Caesar Milan, also known as the Dog Whisperer. The real-life Milan trains owners to be dominant pack leaders to their dogs. Here he tries to help Mrs. Cartman bring her son to heel.
Okay, let me show you how to express the dominant energy. What I've done is I've brought over some Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Ooh, Colonel?
I am going to eat first, because that is what the pack leader does.
Give me the chicken. Give me some chicken. What are you doing? I want chicken! Give me some chicken!
I am not going to acknowledge the child's attempt at aggressive, dominant behavior. Now you eat the chicken.
Mom, give me some chicken. I want some chicken, Mom.
We won't reward him until he's in a calm, submissive behavior.
God damn it, I am not a dog!
Of course, in the end, the Dog Whisperer leaves and Cartman reverts to his old self, the do-anything, say-anything walking id that he is. Trey Parker says he really wouldn't have it any other way.
He is basically the dark side of everyone. And I think everyone's got a little Cartman in them. And I think it's, you know, you need a little Cartman in you once in a while.
Or at least once a week. Julie Rovner, NPR News. What profession would you not like to do when you grow up?
Probably be an interviewer, actually.
Okay, I'll take that in the way I'm sure it was intended.
Eric Cartman answers the Proust questionnaire at our website, where you can also nominate your own favorite characters for our series. Just go to npr.org/incharacter.
Well, more movie memories now. She was unfaithful and a shrew in the film Of Human Bondage, spoiled and headstrong in Jezebel, devious and scheming in The Little Foxes, and only a fool would tangle with her Margot Channing in All About Eve.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Bette Davis was by many measures the great movie star of Hollywood's studio system, and she was born 100 years ago this week. Bette Davis movies play constantly on television, but for her 100th birthday, Bob Mondello wants us to consider and to hear a less familiar Bette Davis.
The artistic dossier on Bette Davis is undeniably impressive. She was a cinematic force of nature in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. No one smoked a cigarette or strode into view or delivered a barbed line with more force than she did. Davis's personal dossier, on the other hand, well, she played difficult women, and she had a reputation for being difficult herself. When the brothers Warner cast her in mediocre movies, she made them sue her before she'd star in them. She fought with director William Wyler, with whom she was madly in love, and with her brother-in-law, a recovering alcoholic to whom she sent two cases of liquor as a wedding present. She feuded with Joan Crawford, an arch-rival she once accused of having slept with every male star at MGM except Lassie. And at the peak of her fame for doing those things, she played a character who did that same kind of thing and had the nerve to try to justify her behavior in All About Eve.
Infants behave the way I do, you know. They carry on and misbehave. They'd get drunk if they knew how. When they can't have what they want. When they feel unwanted or insecure or unloved.
Okay, that's the character, and Davis herself wasn't that kind of insecure. She knew she was good, and as she took home Oscar nomination after Oscar nomination, 8 in 10 years, all for Best Actress, the industry kept reminding her. And then it discarded her, calling her difficult and washed up and over the hill at 40, which is when she made All About Eve. And even though it won her another Best Actress nomination, it didn't restart her career. In fact, it did her so little good that a year later, she did something that I'd say proved that Betty Davis was not difficult at all, that she would, in fact, do absolutely anything she was asked.
Mr. Conductor, if you please.
She would even appear on stage in a musical revue called Two's Company.
Don't want to cruise the Riviera. Don't want a diamond mine. Want to smell grease paint in dressing rooms where a coveted Oscar is Hammerstein. Just turn me loose on Broadway.
Painful, no? Now, the thing about live theater is that you don't get to do it once and then you're finished. You have to do it every night. And the minute the producers announced that Betty Davis was doing a musical revue, it started selling out. So she was going to have to do a lot of nights. Standing room only tryouts in Detroit, Philadelphia, and Boston. An enormous advance on Broadway. It didn't really matter that the show was terrible and Davis couldn't sing. Except to her, of course. Rumors had been circulating during rehearsals that she was sick, she was dropping out, she was being replaced by Martha Ray. All false, as it happened, though she was tired. At the show's first performance in front of an audience, she finished the opening number and almost immediately collapsed. When she revived, she blew the crowd a kiss and said, "Well, you can't say I didn't fall for you. This is a woman who's difficult."
Oh, you kid!
The lady's a lamb, which didn't keep the producers from leading her to slaughter. They called in show doctors who didn't do much except encourage the star to do a lot of unstar-like things.
A 1, a 2, a 3,
a 4.
It's tricky.
She even sang a song as a gap-toothed, pipe-smoking hillbilly.
Oh, do, dee-do,
boop-boop,
a-do, hey!
Critic Walter Kerr wrote at the Broadway opening, "Miss Davis unbends so much, there's some doubt whether she'll ever be able to straighten up again."
Ha! Boop, boop, ba-doop, bo-do, dee-do,
hey!
She ended up giving more than 150 performances in Two's Company before returning to Hollywood, where, once again, no one paid much attention to her, until she earned a 10th Oscar nomination as a horror film gargoyle in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. At which point, at 54, she was again written off as over the hill. Finished. Imagine that happening to Meryl Streep or Helen Mirren, both of whom are older and neither of whom is remotely as big in Hollywood as Davis was at her peak. Unthinkable, right? But that was then. So Davis did what a woman of a certain age had to. She compromised, not her standards, but her fees, and went on television and did more theater, including another stab at a musical, believe it or not. Even after a stroke and recurring bouts of cancer, she continued working right up until the year she died. So excuse me, a temper tantrum or two, a bitchy remark, or 6, entirely understandable. Betty Davis may have raised her voice on occasion, but difficult? What she was up against was difficult. And despite that, for 6 decades, she played tough, sexy broads in a way that suggested that a tough, sexy broad was what any sensible woman would want to be. I'm Bob Mandela.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Sports fans in Boston will be going into the baseball season missing one major figure, A local sportscasting legend, Bob Lobel has led fans through some 30 seasons. He will now be replaced by a new, presumably cheaper, sportscaster. Lobel is one of the latest to take a buyout from a local station struggling to deal with declining advertising revenues and shrinking audiences. NPR's Tovia Smith reports.
Not long ago, it would have been unimaginable for a local station to cut loose its anchors or sportscasters who've basically defined its brand.
Good morning, everybody. We begin with the Red Sox. Bob Lobel joins us now.
All right, yeah, they got their workout in with, of course, Dice K. Matsuzaka getting the star treatment in his native land.
Bob Lobel has become a kind of star himself, covering Boston sports teams for nearly 30 years. But with TV stations losing viewers and advertisers to cable and the internet, it's been anchors away. And even the sports guys are now being cut.
Way through the line and look at the stiff arm to give the Indians. That was the Heisman right there.
Lobel and a high-profile entertainment reporter leave WBZ in what one industry insider describes as a bloodbath. 32 staffers, making up 15% of the station's workforce, are leaving. It's among the largest reductions announced this week at CBS stations around the nation, surprising even veterans like longtime TV executive Charlie Kravitz.
The level of cutbacks is pretty dramatic. And clearly, there seems to be a new sense of urgency that something has to change.
WBZ management declined to comment, but Kravitz says the cuts make financial sense in this new era of digital media, and especially in sports, at a time when sports teams own their own TV outlets and control their own copyrighted material.
Across the nation, stations are cutting back on their local sports coverage, partially because they're competing with the teams that they are covering, and partially because there doesn't seem to be the payoff that used to be because of the competitive landscape.
Today, with so many cable stations and internet sites in the mix, Kravitz says even the most popular on-air personalities can't translate into ratings and revenues, so it's harder for managers to justify those six- and seven-figure salaries.
I'm sure they recognize that Bob, who has been an icon in this marketplace, is not saving them from being a third or fourth place news operation right now.
Indeed, while many lament the departure of a Boston sports legend, other Boston sports fans are shrugging their shoulders.
No big deal to me. It wouldn't be a big deal to me if any of them retired.
66-year-old Arnie Zaff says it's been a long time since he's even watched the local TV sports guys.
I usually don't get my news on TV.
Instead, you go
to the newspaper or the internet.
The challenge for local TV now is to figure out ways to compete based on its format rather than on-air personalities. Kravitz is one who says it wouldn't be a bad thing if local stations were defined more by the kind of news they deliver rather than by who's doing the delivering. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. India is the home of the ancient how-to sex text, the Kama Sutra, but modern times have left much of that country with a different view of sexuality. It's often a taboo subject now. There is one TV talk show that is raising questions about sex and so far at least getting away with it. Scott Carney reports from Chennai, India, on The Rise of Rose, a talk show host with uncommon credentials.
On the TV screen, a woman in a peach-colored sari and a sultry smile looks defiantly at the camera. The stage is shaped like the symbol of femininity, an O with a plus sign hanging off. The male symbol hangs behind her. Slowly, the camera zooms in on Rose's face, revealing diamond earrings, a jeweled necklace, and a bindi on her forehead. If you're tuning in for the first time, you might not know that she was born a boy.
The topics that we handle are pretty controversial for the Indian audience here.
That's Rose, host of the talk show Ipadiku Rose. One of her programs advocated legalizing prostitution. She also tackled harassment in the workplace, divorce, and premarital sex. They're issues that rarely get talked about in India, but Rose says that they're among India's most pressing.
I want to break that big myth that they have by being a highly educated, a highly articulate, beautiful, sociable transsexual person who's talking about social issues, issues of large social concern, you know, their own problems.
Rose brings sex talk to the table in a way that others in India haven't been able to do without serious backlash. In 2005, a popular Tamil actress said that there should be frank and open dialogue about premarital sex in Chennai. Just a few days later, Hindu fundamentalists were on her doorstep with a lawsuit. They demanded that she retract her grave insult to Tamil womanhood. But when Rose broaches the same issues, no one flinches.
Somebody had to take up these issues, bring it to the open for a discussion, and Rose has done it.
That's Arun Ram, Metro editor at the Times of India in Chennai, who's been following Rose's rise to fame.
And also in the long run will help the society fight the moral policing by the government, by the political parties, by the so-called culture vultures.
One of the reasons that Rose is able to broach sexual topics is precisely because of the low status that transsexuals have in Indian society. Most people fear them. Already at the bottom, the normal guardians of sexual morals can't exactly knock Rose down any more rungs. In a Chennai slum, a group of transgenders called Hijras gathered to beg in front of a medical supply shop. These are the workaday Hijras, representing the vast majority who haven't been embraced by the media. Many end up working in brothels. Priya Babu is a transgender social worker who used to be a prostitute.
Most Hijras are into the sex trade and begging. But the sex trade can be very dangerous since they face violence from police and local rowdies who rape them or demand bribes.
And Rose believes that telling her own story of abuse on the air will help lessen the plight of all Hijras.
So there was so much I went through when I was outside, you know. There was no income, there was ridicule, there was physical abuse. I was even raped once by a group of drunken men. And out of that, I decided that I need to do something big. And so I sat down and developed this talk show concept.
Only about 1% of India is transgender. Priya Babu says that media attention is beginning to make things better for this tiny minority.
Now that people can see Rose on TV, people are starting to accept us. We finally have a voice that people listen to, and they don't fear us as much.
Indeed, that was exactly the reaction of Valsala Vasu, a government social worker in North Chennai. She says that before the talk show, she used to despise Hijras. Since seeing the show, she has begun to see them as a valued third perspective.
Hijras have a male body and a female soul, so they know both genders. This society never knew how Hijras thought and felt. Now, when Rose speaks, we understand that they can offer a new dimension to the conversation.
And so far, audiences seem receptive to a Hijra talking frankly about sex. Message boards on Vijay TV's website overflow with compliments and suggestions. Yet even with the positive response, Rose is afraid that someday a backlash against her may come. She's ready if it does, she says.
I will be in the media. I will be there for a long time. Unless, of course, someone kills me. Until I die, I'll be there. I'll expose their hypocrisy, and I'll continue to be a celebrity.
For NPR News, I'm Scott Carney in Chennai, India.